Hey, it's Marco Werman.
And Carolyn Buehler.
You know this show and count on this podcast for global news with a special twist. But this podcast exists thanks to public radio stations.
If you don't already listen to your local public radio station, think about giving it a try. It's a great way to keep up with what's going on in your own community and discover more great shows.
And if you're so inclined, with your public radio station holding their spring pledge drive right now, help them expand their reach and service by giving whatever amount works for you.
And thanks.
The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
From Moscow tonight, news reports say armed men burst into a concert hall with guns and explosives. Russian officials say more than 40 people were killed. I'm Marco Werman. Also on the show today, opposing views about the war in Gaza are also fueling animosity on American college campuses.
A lot of people are not willing to have a conversation. It's, you know, their way or the highways.
And after violent demonstrations and a postponed election date, voters in Senegal head to the polls this weekend to choose a new president.
Most people are relieved.
Plus, an art installation in Australia for women only.
A place for women to retreat to escape the patriarchy, to enjoy the company of each other and indulge in a beautiful experience. And I think that the rejection of men is a very central and important part of the artwork.
Those stories and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us on this Friday. We begin with a developing story out of Moscow tonight. Russian news reports say that a group of men in combat fatigues, armed with automatic weapons and explosives, attack concertgoers in a theater. More than 40 people were killed and more than 100 injured, according to the Russian Federal Security Service. Many details are still sketchy. No group claimed immediate responsibility for any attack. The World's Daniel Hoffman is following the breaking news from Riga, the capital of Latvia. Daniel, what do we know so far about what happened in Moscow tonight?
So as you said, Marco, we know that a shooting took place. It took place at the Krokus City Hall, which is a shopping center and music venue on the western edge of Moscow. A crowd of people were gathered there this evening for a rock concert. And according to earlier reports, we know that there were several shooters. Some videos are already appearing online of the shooters opening fire on unarmed people inside the concert hall. And there are videos online of a blaze of fire coming from the rooftop of the venue. And within the last few hours, we've also seen videos online of security forces entering the facility. But we still don't have a lot of the details. We don't know who the shooters were. We don't know their motives. And we don't know if they were detained or if they remain at large. So this thing is ongoing, and that's as much as we know as of now.
Gotcha. So what have Russian officials said so far about this incident?
So earlier this evening, the mayor of Moscow, Sergei Sobyanin, came out with a statement saying, "Today a terrible tragedy occurred at the Krokus City Shopping Center. My condolences to the loved ones of the victims." But he didn't share much more specific information. But now again, within the last few hours, we heard from Russia's Federal Security Service. As you noted, the FSB came out with more information. They said in a statement that at least 40 people were killed and more than 100 injured. And earlier today, we also heard from the White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby. Here's what he said about the shooting.
Can't speak much to the details of it. I mean, this was all just breaking before I came on out here, so we're trying to get more information, but really would refer to Russian authorities to speak to it. The images are just horrible and just hard to watch, and our thoughts obviously are going to be with the victims of this terrible, terrible shooting attack.
So this is a developing story, and as we heard from the White House, they didn't share much, and those numbers that we have from Russian officials, they're preliminary. And they can change.
Now, I understand that the U.S. Embassy in Moscow recently put out a warning about terrorist attacks being planned in Moscow. What did that warning say?
Yeah, so this is an interesting note, and some people are making a connection here. So the U.S. Embassy in Moscow came out with a security alert on March 7th. It said to avoid crowds for the next 48 hours, and the warning said that extremists have imminent plans to target large gatherings in Moscow. And so now we're seeing again the U.S. Embassy in Moscow is warning U.S. citizens who are in Russia to avoid crowds and large gatherings.
Well, it is a developing story, and as you said, Daniel, we're still learning the details about this attack in Moscow. Remind us, though, this sort of thing has not happened in years in Russia, correct?
Yeah, Marco, there haven't been many incidents like this. We've seen some attacks in the past on the metro systems in Moscow and St. Petersburg. In the early 2000s, there were some high-profile hostage situations at a theater in Moscow and at a school in southern Russia. But again, we still don't know enough about this incident to make comparisons. What we do know is that this is one of the biggest attacks like this that we've seen in Russia in many years.
The World's Daniel Hoffman is based in Riga, Latvia. Daniel, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Turning now to the UN, earlier today, the United States introduced a Security Council resolution calling for an immediate and sustained ceasefire in Gaza. It was vetoed by Russia and China. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken was back in the Middle East. He met with Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu after meetings with Arab leaders earlier in the week. This continues to be a high-wire act. Blinken is pushing for a deal on a ceasefire, the release of Israeli hostages, and for badly needed humanitarian aid for Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Alon Pincus is a former political advisor to two Israeli prime ministers. I spoke with him earlier today and asked what Netanyahu is probably hearing from Blinken.
Well, he's hearing from Blinken that unless Israel gets its act together, it faces further isolation, further confrontation with the U.S. administration, with him, Blinken, and obviously with President Biden, and that if Israel is still entertaining any thoughts of a large-scale operation in the southern part of the Gaza Strip near the city of Rafah, then the consequences may be dire.
Can you elaborate on what you think the dire consequences would be if the Netanyahu government were to insist on a invasion of Rafah? I mean, are you saying that it could be what the U.S. has been seeing as a no-go move up to now, pulling back weapons assistance to Israel?
That's on the menu. I don't think the U.S. Offered it to make that a policy yet, but the leaks are there. And there has been already, Marco, a slowdown in some weapons, or rather armaments and munitions supplies to Israel. What the prime minister has been doing in the last few days is being intransigent and saying that with or without U.S. help, this will pass. Now, going back to the consequences, it's not just the arms, it's also the UN Security Council with which we began our conversation.
Right.
It's also Israel's increased isolation. It's also the fact that the U.S. is the only one right now officially or ostensibly backing Israel. So these would be the consequences. The one thing I think, Marco, the U.S. is not taking into consideration is that this is exactly what Mr. Netanyahu wants.
But how does that advance Netanyahu's own political fortunes? Like, why would Netanyahu want a fight with the U.S.?
In two ways. First, it prolongs the war. He needs the war to be prolonged. If there is a ceasefire, a lengthy and extended ceasefire, he's going to be subject to mass demonstrations and calls for an inquiry commission and calls for his resignation, or conversely, calls for an early election. So he needs to maintain the atmosphere of war is going on, and that sort of makes a lot of Israelis uncomfortable demonstrating against him. More importantly, perhaps, is the fact that he's trying, or has tried and partially succeeded in offering a completely parallel narrative, that this was not about October 7th, that this is about something much bigger. A Palestinian state that, lo and behold, the Biden administration is trying to impose on Israel. This, of course, is a prefabricated argument, but nonetheless, he believes this is going to help him. Look, he's polling abysmally. He would be thrashed in any election should it be held in the next few months. So he needs this war to go on, and he needs the narrative to go on as if this is about something much bigger that he's standing up.
How many people in Israel agreed with Senator Chuck Schumer saying Netanyahu needs to be voted out of office? And has there been any kind of actual uptake on or action on that?
It was taken, you know, as some kind of a, well, he told us what we already say to each other, but he shouldn't be telling us this, which is a natural, it's a silly, but it's a natural reaction from people.
Alon Pincus, I got to ask you, you've worked with U.S. counterparts a lot over the course of your career. What does it feel like for you personally watching this crisis in the U.S.-Israeli relationship play out?
horrible. It's like a train wreck, but it's no longer in slow motion. Friends of mine are asking me, how is Israel still an American ally if it behaves like a constant high-maintenance ongoing crisis? And this is extraordinarily depressing to hear.
Alon Pincus is a former advisor to two Israeli prime ministers. He was giving us his view on the current state of U.S.-Israeli relations. The war in Gaza continues to grip the attention of people here in the U.S., especially on college campuses. Jewish and Muslim students say these last several months have taken a toll. Not only has the divide between them grown wider, but many of those students here in the U.S. say they just don't feel safe at school, precisely because of their views on Israel, the Palestinians, and the war in Gaza. From the higher education desk at GBH in Boston, Kirk Carapeza has more.
Talia Khan says she always felt safe in Cambridge, Massachusetts, studying engineering as an undergrad at MIT and performing in the university's jazz band. Here she is singing the song Lonely Moments.
Lonely moments day after day.
Khan is the daughter of an American Jewish mother, an Afghan Muslim father, and after October 7th, she says she feared for her safety.
We had students immediately saying, you know, all of this violence is Israel's fault.
She lost friendships and her mental health suffered as the climate on campus has grown more polarized.
I personally had best friends who I spent a lot of time studying with, and they told me that the people who were killed in the Nova massacre deserved to be killed because they were partying on stolen land. It took me so long to process that anybody could say that. There's no excuse for, you know, killing, raping, kidnapping innocent people.
Since the war in Gaza broke out 5 months ago, students like Khan have found themselves on deeply divided college campuses, where many pro-Palestinian and pro-Israeli activists have stopped communicating and are worrying about their own safety. With both anti-Semitism and Islamophobia on the rise, a new report from the University of Chicago, based on surveys of 5,000 students, found that more than half of Jewish and Muslim students feel unsafe on campus because of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Campus fears are more intense and more widespread than we've previously known.
Robert Pappy studies political violence and is the author of the report.
October 7th caught us all by surprise, but especially caught college campuses and universities by surprise.
Did your survey find that these students have reason to be afraid?
Yes, they're hearing protest chants they interpret as a call to genocide, and that's scaring not just the target group that they hear, but it's scaring everybody. They're observing acts of violence and intimidation on campus.
Part of the problem, Pappy says, is that students view intimidation differently.
You have one group of students who are chanting from the river to the sea that don't think it is implying genocide of the Jews, but you've got 4 million college students hearing that phrase thinking that means genocide of the Jews. So this is simply a tragic misunderstanding.
For many Muslim students, like Harvard junior Jana Amin, the harm they feel is also real. In October, her image appeared on a doxing truck that drove around campus and identified students involved in pro-Palestinian causes and labeled them Harvard's leading anti-Semites.
I was devastated and really scared for my own personal safety on campus, right? Like walking around, might someone recognize me from the truck and then choose to kind of take it a step further and turn to violence?
Before October 7th, Amin says she had a lot of trust in the campus community, but the doxing truck took a toll.
Just seeing the truck allowed to stand there with my face and name on it forever altered how I was going to think about my time at Harvard.
Jewish students who support Israel are also losing trust in their colleges.
A lot of people are not willing to have a conversation. It's, you know, their way or the highway.
Becca Packer is a senior at Berklee College of Music and a member of the college's newly organized Hillel, a Jewish campus group. Sitting in the back of a campus cafe, she says after October 7th, she found anti-Semitic posts and attempts to deny violence against Israeli women all over social media.
One of my first things that I knew I had to do following October 7th was get on Instagram and try and be that opposing voice, that, you know, opposing perspective that people aren't going to see, because I knew exactly what was going to happen.
Dartmouth student Roan Wade says she and other students who support Palestinians have been treated like criminals for engaging in peaceful protest. She says she fears for her own safety, and she's been harassed online and on campus.
I'll get the occasional threat, the occasional comment calling me a terrorist.
At MIT, the climate is still tense. Talia Khan, the daughter of Jewish and Muslim parents, says she no longer wears her Star of David necklace, and some former friends have blocked her on Instagram.
They didn't want to listen. They wanted to stay in their bubble. It's awkward seeing people that you were once really good friends with who now refuse to talk to you or look you in the eye just because you believe that Israel has a right to exist and they do not.
Khan says she wants administrators to forcefully discipline students who use what she hears as violent language against anyone on campus. For The World, Kurt Carapeza, Boston.
An art installation in Australia has led to some courtroom drama. It's happening in Hobart, the capital city of the Australian state of Tasmania, where a man is suing the Museum of Old and New Art, or MONA for short. His lawsuit is focused on an installation called The Ladies' Lounge. From Sydney, The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
The Ladies' Lounge at MONA is an opulent space. There are crystal chandeliers, velvet couches, Picasso's on the wall. It's cordoned off from the rest of the museum by heavy silk curtains in a sumptuous emerald green. The entrance is guarded, and only people who identify as women are allowed in. Or rather, there are some men. The lounge is staffed by male butlers who pour champagne and give foot rubs to the women inside. So, a lot like home, in other words. The artist, Kirsha Keshela, spoke to Australia's public broadcaster about the concept behind Ladies' Lounge.
A place for women to retreat to escape the patriarchy, to enjoy the company of each other and indulge in a beautiful experience. And I think that the rejection of men is a very central and important part of the artwork.
But rejection can sting, even when it's in the name of art. In April last year, a man named Jason Lau visited the museum and paid his $23 entrance fee, only to be told he wasn't allowed into the lounge. Now, other male visitors have complained before, but Lau sued, arguing the museum was violating Tasmania's anti-discrimination laws. The matter went to Tasmania's Civil and Administrative Tribunal this week. Keshela showed up in a navy power suit, red lips, and pearls. She brought a posse of women with her, all dressed the same way. During the hearing, they read to themselves from feminist texts and then danced out of the building in a conga line with someone playing the song Simply Irresistible from their iPhone.
The hearing really felt like the art coming to life. It was a living part of the work.
Tasmania's Anti-Discrimination Act actually allows for some discrimination if it helps promote equal opportunity for a disadvantaged group. And this is exactly what the museum's lawyer is arguing, that Ladies' Lounge promotes equal opportunity by addressing a long history of women being excluded from male-only spaces. If he wins, Jason Lau isn't asking for any money. He either wants the Ladies' Lounge to close or for men to be allowed in. He also said it would be okay if men were charged a discounted entrance fee. The museum said that was a no-go. A decision from the tribunal is expected in the next few weeks. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum, Sydney.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. This winter has been a brutal one for Mongolia. Record snowfalls followed by extreme cold have killed an estimated 5 million herd animals. Sheep, goats, cattle, camels, and horses have all perished, leaving Mongolian herders with nothing to show for their labor. Mars Wasabi has been following all of this. He's a professor of Mongolian history at Columbia University and City University of New York. Mars, Mongolians have a word for these crippling winters, zuds. I understand. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but what is a zud and why is it particular to Mongolia?
Well, the term is zud, and it's peculiar to Mongolia in that you have these horrendous winters approximately once every 5 years throughout history. They're preceded oftentimes by summer droughts. And so the animals don't have enough to eat in the summer. They're not fattened up, and they're very vulnerable when cold occurs and the snow also harms them. And that leads to real problems for the herders.
And tell us about the herders in Mongolia. How many people are we talking about who could potentially be impacted by this?
It's about 30% of the population, which would mean a little bit less than 1 million people.
When herders lose their animals, like we've seen this year, what is the impact on the Mongolian economy?
Well, it's devastating for the herders themselves. More and more, however, mining has come to replace the herding economy as the basis for export and a richer life for some of the population. But on the other hand, the herders who can't make it, whose animals die during a dzud, during one of these catastrophic events, many of them have moved into the city. And there are now about half the population lives in Ulaanbaatar, the capital city, which is untenable. These folks don't live in apartment buildings, they live in tents, as they do in the countryside, but they don't have regular access to drinking water, to running water. They don't have necessarily access to good sewage facilities, and that leads to a considerable amount of poverty in the country.
Can you take us deeper into the lives of Mongolian herders, Morris? You explained with the dzud cycle between summer and winter. I mean, their year must be driven by the needs of their animals.
Yes.
How does a winter like this past one factor into their own families' lives, like aside from migrating to cities? What does this mean for a herder's family?
Well, they do migrate, and they're dependent on the tools that they require to move from one location and the animals that they require. Camels, very important, because they provide the transport for the herders, for their tents, for their clothing, for tools that they need. And the number of camels has gone down. Now they're being replaced to a certain extent. Some wealthy herders have trucks or motorcycles or whatever, and they're able to get on. But some are not, and they're, again, a vulnerable group that winds up in the cities.
I mean, Morris, given how crucial livestock is to the Mongolian economy, plus preserving a traditional way of life like herding would seem to be in the public interest, what kinds of supports do Mongolian authorities have to protect nomadic families from, honestly, ruin?
Well, that's the problem. Both the government and outside aid organizations focus mostly on the cities and focus mostly on mining. Mining has become a major part of the Mongolian economy, and the efforts in those areas are strong, but the efforts in terms of saving and protecting the herding economy have dissipated, and so the percentage of herders has, in fact, gone down over the past 30 years or so. Obviously, herding will survive. It's part of the Mongolian ethic, it's part of Mongolian values, part of Mongolian life, but I think there'll be a decrease in the number of herders, and certainly with climate change, with competition from mining, with relatively little support from the government, the herding suffers.
Morris Wasabi teaches Mongolian history at Columbia University and City University of New York. He was updating us on the lives of Mongolian herders, many of whose animals perish this year in a record cold winter. On Sunday, millions of people in Senegal will be voting for a new president. This is the first time an incumbent will not be on the presidential ballot. It's being called the most wide-open election since Senegal's independence in 1960. But voting day also comes after weeks of political chaos and uncertainty and street violence. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi reports.
Many people worried that Sunday's presidential election might not happen. Gilles Yabi is the founder and director of the West African citizen think tank WAFI in Dakar.
Most people are relieved that the date of election now should hold. And I think most of the Senegalese just want to go to this election.
Senegal's election was meant to happen on February 25th. Ahead of it, the country's president, Macky Sall, announced he would delay the election till December, citing electoral disputes. Opposition leaders called it an institutional coup.
It created definitely a lot of political tensions, a lot of international attention also for the country, and was certainly not positive for the image of the country.
Senegal has been considered a model of democracy in the region, which has been beset by coups. In recent years, he wavered over whether he could run for a third term. Last year, Sall pledged not to run in this election.
And I think the last few months also showed that they were not really prepared to leave power. He was not prepared to leave.
After Sall's announcement, thousands of people protested in the streets. More than a dozen people were killed and hundreds were arrested. Yabi tells me it was this public pressure that gave Senegal's courts the courage to stand against the president and overturn his decision.
That has given confidence in the possibility for Senegal to actually safeguard his tradition of quite strong democratic institution.
Still, Yabi says there are serious concerns about the quality of this election, given the short time frame.
Je n'ai pas d'excuse à faire, puisque je n'ai commis aucune faute.
I have no apology to make, and I did nothing wrong, is what Senegal's president, Macky Sall, told the BBC in an interview this week. He confirmed that he will leave office on April 2nd. 19 people have been cleared to run on the ballot to replace him. One of them is Bassirou Diomaye Faye, a 43-year-old tax inspector who is running in place of popular Senegalese opposition leader Ousmane Sane, who was not cleared to run in this election. Last week, people celebrated in the streets when the two were released from prison. Both figures have gained a lot of popularity among Senegal's youth for calling out corruption in the government. Faye's main challenger is former Prime Minister Amadou Ba, who is backed by the president and the ruling party. The election could go to a runoff if no one gets 50% of the vote. Yabi explains to me what the biggest issues are for most voters.
The economy and job creation is a main issue, but I would say also governance in the question of perception of inequality and corruption.
Yabi says this whole political crisis indicates that despite the challenges to Senegal's democracy, the people there still largely want it. He says it's up for elected officials, though, to prove democracy can transform people's lives for the better. For the world, I'm Halima Gekandi, Nairobi.
K-pop, K-dramas, K-beauty. South Korea has a lot of cultural influence. Those who know the word Hallyu, or the Korean wave to describe the power of K-everything.
For us, it's more than just a hobby. Like, it's something that we love. It's something that brings us all together.
Celebrating South Korean pop culture, that's still ahead here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Egypt, President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has been in power for about a decade. His government has earned a reputation for its widespread human rights abuses. Journalists, civil society leaders, and peace activists have faced harassment, jail time, and asset freezes. Hossam Bagat, the director of the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights, knows this all too well. He has faced an investigation that has lasted more than a decade. But this week it concluded and the charges against him were dropped. Hossam is based in Cairo. Hossam Bagat, what was at the heart of the legal case against you?
It was initiated by Mubarak-era holdovers and wanted to punish those that were accused of having fomented mass uprisings and also make sure that this is not repeated in the future. So this is how this witch hunt started. But it was only under the current military dictatorship of Abdel Fattah el-Sisi that in 2016, the investigation was used to go after almost every prominent or head of an independent human rights organization with so-called provisional measures.
Yes, so can I ask you what you were subjected to during the 13 years that you and the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights were being investigated?
These took the shape of an open-ended travel ban, purportedly until the investigation is over, and the freeze on all my personal assets and properties, suspension of my only bank account, preventing me from using the banking system or having a debit or credit card. That went on for 8 years. And of course, during those 8 years, there was no investigation. There was no process of collecting evidence or hearing testimonies. It was just an open-ended, politically motivated, judicial in name only process.
Yeah, so 13 years and six judges later, how does it feel to now get the vindication that you sought for so long?
Of course, the vindication is important, and it is, I think, the right word. The most significant damage came through the smear campaign of calling it the foreign funding case, and dragging us on for this for the past 13 years as defendants accused of accepting funds from malicious Western forces trying to undermine the country and harm national interests. There is, of course, a sense that we demand restitution for this kind of moral enmity.
I mean, the case was dropped. I'm just curious, what is the atmosphere right now for human rights advocates working in Egypt? How different is it from, say, 13 years ago when this investigation started?
Over the last 10 years, the entire civic space in Egypt was not just limited, but really eviscerated. And the human rights community was only part of it, but it affected the media, the right to protest, political parties and opposition activities, community-based activism, the labor movement, the student movement, you name it. So we paid the price just like others. Right now, there hasn't been a course correction, and there isn't likely to be a course correction under the current leadership. And the problem is, of course, that the same repressive laws that made it possible for this farce of a judicial process to go on for 13 years and caused so much damage is still in place.
Help us understand, Hossam, why are rights activists being targeted by the Egyptian government? Like, fundamentally, what's at the root of it?
The hostility of the Sisi regime towards the human rights community is not a result necessarily of the impact of our work or our ability to influence its conduct, but to our success in controlling the narrative and make it impossible for this regime, no matter how much it spent to purchase and acquire every media outlet in the country, no matter how much money it spent on PR firms in the US and Europe and lobbyists, it is impossible for this regime to whitewash its human rights conduct because there is a very small and, admittedly, human rights community that is just documenting what is happening and putting the truth out there. And that is really fundamentally the regime's problem with us, is that we are calling out its conduct, and we are the only ones really able, against all odds, to scream that the emperor has no clothes.
Hossam, you've expressed your concern that you could be investigated again as a human rights activist. Despite that, will you continue your work in Egypt?
Absolutely. I have no intention of leaving Egypt, and I plan to continue my work here. But it is also important to note that three of my colleagues at the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights are facing several other charges in a separate investigation. They are also under a travel ban and an asset freeze. So the possibility of me being subjected to another investigation is not a theoretical one. There is actually still open criminal investigations into our human rights work. And that is also another reason for us to continue and press with this work.
Hossam Bagat is the director of the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights. He joined us from Cairo. About 100 years ago, United Fruit, then an American company, reigned supreme in Central America. It didn't just own banana plantations, but also railroads and telephone lines. The company dictated national policies and overthrew governments. For his podcast, Under the Shadow, about U.S. involvement in Central America, reporter Michael Fox recently traveled to Guatemala, where he looked at the legacy of the United Fruit Company and its impact on the fruit industry today.
So right now I'm standing in front of La Torre Supermarkets. And then there's this mall here. And right beside, actually underneath, where there is now this mall on the side of this major highway, this is where the rails used to run. These rails used to take the bananas from here in Tiquisate all the way to the port over on the Caribbean side, on the other side of the country.
Within 12 hours, 10 million bananas have been taken aboard and the ship is on its way to the United States.
As this movie, made by United Fruit in the 1940s, described, most of the bananas produced in Central America were shipped to the United States. Roughly 70 years ago, the town of Tiquisate was the center of United Fruit production in Guatemala. You can still find the remnants of the company hidden in plain sight across the city.
Green wooden homes, tin roofs, and then brick below. Two room, two stories. Oh, wow, it just keeps going for this in this neighborhood here.
That was one of several neighborhoods built to house United Fruit employees in Tiquisate.
Yeah, Chelsea.
Carla Juarez is a receptionist at a white two-story hotel there. Just beside the parking lot, one of these old United Fruit homes is falling apart. We walk over to it. Yeah, there are many of these little houses that are still around, she tells me. They called them airplane style because of the slanted roofs. I stare at the home. It looks like it's been transplanted here from the United States. My grandmother worked there, Juarez says. She was a nurse at the company hospital, so she received one just like this. Juarez and her mother still live in the home. A few blocks away, lawyer Antonio Granillo and his wife are sitting at the bottom of the stairs that lead up to their former company home. They've been here for almost a decade.
Wow. 50 years ago,
all of the homes were made like this, Granillo says, and they were all the same color, green. The way he describes it, the town was booming back then, and for many here, those were the good old days. The company paid much higher wages than the average in Guatemala at the time. It provided housing. Workers poured in from the Caribbean coast and other parts of the country. But according to historians, it was not easy work. Long, back-breaking hours, no rights, dangerous quantities of pesticides, irregular pay. United Fruit ran its operations like a kingdom, and it had huge sway over the countries in the region. It's where the term Banana Republic comes from.
Sweep across the skies over Guatemala City.
In 1954, the company played a key role in the overthrow of Guatemala's democratically elected president, Jacobo Arbenz, after he passed land reform impacting United Fruit properties. Today, driving around Central America, Tiquisate is not the only place where you can glimpse into the past of United Fruit. The company's former homes, roads, and distribution plants are mixed into the landscape. Some of them are still in operation, owned by other agribusiness firms, much of them today producing palm oil. There's another legacy of United Fruit that is much closer to home. I recently sent my parents to go look for it.
Okay, we're in Trader Joe's.
My parents live in Northern Virginia. See, the company Chiquita was formed out of a defunct United Fruit in the 1980s. It's no longer a U.S. company. It's now based in Switzerland and owned by Brazilian firms. But it's still a huge banana producer, and the brand is still everywhere in the United States.
Really, it doesn't say Chiquita?
No, but it's
got the Chiquita. It looks like the woman on top of hers, you know, doing that Chiquita dance.
I asked them how much bananas were there at the store.
19 cents each. These are non-organic.
19 cents a piece, less than 60 cents a pound for a tropical fruit in the winter in the United States. Well under half the cost of a pound of local apples.
That is the terrible legacy today of the United Fruit Company.
Jenny Coleman is the president of Equifruit, a fair trade banana company based in Montreal.
Often people will say, oh, banana production has changed since the bad old days. There have been changes. There have been improvements on pesticide use or worker safety. But the main legacy of United Fruit is promising cheap fruit.
And experts say they've achieved this by transforming the banana into an industrial product.
The banana we eat in the United States, the banana everyone eats who doesn't live in a banana-growing country, is as industrialized as a McDonald's hamburger.
Dan Coppell is the author of Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World.
A banana plantation is a factory. It is a factory that is producing a uniform product as uniform as Henry Ford produced Model A's. And that's really the way to look at it. And it's been that way for over 100 years.
Coppell says tissue-cultured plants on banana farms are grown in test tubes to ensure uniformity. They require tremendous amounts of pesticides throughout their life cycle to ward off nearly a dozen common banana blights. Coppell says companies have kept costs low with cheap land and cheap labor.
And it's not just because of climate that bananas are produced mostly in third world countries. You don't see a lot of export bananas coming from Australia, for example, even though they have a big internal banana crop, because it costs too much money to produce bananas. So for over 100 years, the business model of the banana industry has been to make this the cheapest fruit in the supermarket.
I reached out to Chiquita with questions about production on their farms. They didn't respond. A few weeks ago, I visited a supermarket in El Salvador. The bananas there were from neighboring Guatemala, 34 cents a pound. Of course, that's roughly half the cost in the United States, but they only had to cross the border. In other words, the legacies of United Fruit run deep. In neighborhoods in Guatemala, processing plants across Central America, and the promise of a cheap banana every time you visit your local supermarket. For The World, I'm Michael Fox. Tikisate, Guatemala.
You can check out other episodes of Under the Shadow wherever you get your podcasts. Any short list of the biggest boy bands of the last decade would have to include South Korea's BTS. With smash hits like this track Butter, BTS became a crucial mover of K-pop to fans around the globe. K-pop is just one piece of South Korea's cultural offerings, though. A new exhibit at Boston's Museum of Fine Arts aims to highlight the full range of Korean pop culture. The World's Bianca Hillier takes us there.
Okay, maybe the exhibit isn't all about K-pop, but it's definitely the centerpiece. The music video for aespa's song Next Level plays on a big screen. Right beneath it are the exact white leather and silver sequin outfits the girl group wears in the video. They're part of a two-story, cage-like display dedicated to K-pop's punk, anarchic style.
There's lots of bold colors and patterns. And no matter how modern the silhouette or the fabric is, these designs don't lose sight of their Korean identity. There are hand-painted extracts from the Korean national anthem on a dress and skirt and suit, and even high-heel shoes.
Another major element of K-pop is its powerful and in-sync choreography. That's what drew Jamie Wong to the exhibit. He hosts events around Boston where people can learn K-pop moves.
For us, it's more than just a hobby. Like, it's something that we love. It's something that brings us all together. So the fact that there is, like, an exhibit that shows this is a serious thing, this is something that means a lot to a lot of people, it's very touching.
There's even an interactive section where you can learn dances right there. As Wong walks through the exhibit, though, he's happy to see how comprehensive it is.
There's an aspect of the culture that will appeal to anyone.
This mass appeal and omnipresence of Korean pop culture around the world is the thesis of the exhibit, which is called Hallyu and means Korean wave.
And this is a term that's coined in early 2000s.
Christina Yu Yu is the Art of Asia chair at the museum.
It started from East Asia first, and then from there it spread to rest of Asia and the Middle East and now the whole world.
The wave includes Korean beauty and its famous 10-step skincare routine, and Korean cinema, from Minari to Squid Game. To the movie Parasite. In 2020, Parasite became the first non-English language film to win Best Picture at the Oscars. Yu Yu says the movie is an example of how Koreans often use entertainment to speak on societal issues.
Yes, it's a story about a rich family and a poor family, but this dichotomy of the haves and have-nots exists everywhere.
She says that's part of the reason why the film resonated with such a global audience. And it's true. Most of the pieces displayed are already really well known. Still, Yu says it's important to put everything in one place to create what she says is the first major exhibit celebrating South Korean pop culture in the U.S.
I think in a way, because everywhere, it's not necessary for people easy to connect the dots. If we put it all together, you really feel, you know, how expensive it is and how really it's in your everyday life.
The exhibit opens at the Museum of Fine Arts this weekend and runs through July 28th. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier, Boston. I bring all the drama, la, la, la.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Water is life, as they say. Hey, life on planet Earth would not exist without it. But a United Nations report out today, World Water Day, lays out a bleak picture. Globally, billions of people do not have access to clean water. And the report says the path the world is on is unsustainable. Agriculture accounts for around 70% of global water use. So becoming more efficient in that one area would go a long way to help. The government in Iraq has taken a step to do this by banning the cultivation of the country's signature Anbar rice because of water shortages. That ban is still in place. Last November, we featured the story from The World's Sarah Hassan, who visited what remains of a rice farm in southern Iraq.
Salah Farik Al-Faraun and his family have been farmers in southern Iraq for generations. While sitting in the living room of his house in Al-Mashhab in Najaf province, his son Muhammad Ziad shows me a picture of their 32-acre farm. It's about 5 miles away from their home.
This is his farm?
In the photo, there's lush green grass as far as the eye can see, soaked in water. But it doesn't look like that anymore. It's now barren and quiet, since there's no one working the land anymore.
No rice. No vegetable, no anything. There is no any plant, only wheat. This wheat, dry. This is the main river, dry.
Al-Faraun used to grow rice in the summer and wheat in the winter. Now he can only grow wheat. Because of severe water shortages, he can no longer grow a special type of rice that is unique to Iraq. It's called anbar, a word in Arabic that refers to its perfume-like fragrance. Al-Faraun describes it through a translator.
Ambar rice,
it's been significant for its smell. It's very significant smell and also very delicious taste.
Delicious, very delicious.
Anbar is a long-grain white rice with a high fat ratio. It's traditionally served with every Iraqi meal. But for the past 2 years, farmers haven't been allowed to grow it. The paddy has to be fully submerged in water, and it takes around 5 months to mature. Because it's water-intensive, Iraq's government has banned farmers from growing it, forcing Iraq to import rice from other countries. Ahmed Salim is a manager of a store at Al-Warda Market in central Baghdad. As he pours some rice into packets for weighing, he says there used to be 5 types of anbar rice, but now there are only 2, and the prices have more than doubled. We depend on Pakistani rice, he says, basmati. Iraq also imports rice from Iran and India, which is less than ideal for Iraqis. The imported rice has a different taste than anbar. For centuries, Iraqis have relied on water from 2 main rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates. They are what gave Iraq, or ancient Mesopotamia, the titles the cradle of civilization and the land between 2 rivers. But that land is drying up.
The climate change has this snowball effect.
Ashraf Shibani is a climate journalist. He says that climate change is one factor. This past summer, temperatures in Iraq reached nearly 122 degrees Fahrenheit, and the country has experienced years of persistent drought. Extreme heat has also devastated crops in neighboring Turkey, which is where the Tigris and Euphrates begin. There are water-sharing agreements among the countries that surround these rivers: Iraq, Iran, Turkey, and Syria. Shibani says that the effects of climate change are exacerbated by poor governance and regional politics.
It's a combination of both, but the impact of climate change will make geopolitics more obvious in the near future because a close coordination will not be an option. It will be mandatory.
Shibani says that Turkey has also faced droughts and lower levels of rainfall and snowmelt in its southern mountains. This means less water is fed into the rivers. Turkey has also embarked on massive construction projects in recent years, including the building of dams and hydroelectric power plants along the Tigris and Euphrates, which Shibani says is another factor.
These projects in Turkey are affecting the quota of water in Iraq.
The Iraqi government hasn't been involved in close negotiations over regional water sharing, says Shibani, because it's been preoccupied with its own internal security issues. Al-Faraun, the farmer who can no longer grow anbar in his fields, agrees that climate change is a factor. In addition to being a farmer, he spent 25 years teaching at an agricultural secondary school for the Ministry of Education. In his home, there are large wooden cabinets filled with books and photos on the walls of his university graduation.
Since 50 years ago, he is a graduate.
This is his class?
There are also photos of him as a government employee meeting with foreign leaders over the years. This has given him an insight into how geopolitics has played into what's happening on his farm. To be able to preserve the seeds for future cultivation, the Iraqi government has allowed for minimal farming in certain areas. They want to prevent the extinction of the variety. Al-Faraun says a government minister visited farmers, telling them they would be compensated, but they have yet to see any assistance. He says the government has to move beyond making visits and promises. Our government has to have serious conversations, not just with Turkey, but with the United Nations, the Arab League, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, and the Non-Aligned Movement to get our rights. Al-Faraun's family has been cultivating these fields for generations, and he's hoping that his children will also have the chance to be able to continue the legacy. For The World, I'm Sara Hassan in Al-Mashhab near Najaf, Iraq.
Speaking of water, the trumpet stylings of Portuguese player Jessica Pina flow like liquid. Pina got some attention on social media a few years ago for a live remix she did with her horn of Destiny Child's 1999 chart-topping Say My Name.
Say, baby, I love you. You ain't running back.
Jessica Pina, as you can hear, leans into the deep house sound. The 30-something musician began playing trumpet at the age of 8. She cites touring with Madonna and the way the Material Girl supported her on stage as one of the high points of her career. If you want a better sense of this trumpeter's vision, check out this other track where Pina improvises over a simple rhythm. This is Stoto Late Night. Portuguese trumpet player Jessica Pina brings us to the end of the hour this Friday. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. We're online 24/7 at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and have yourselves a relaxing weekend.
From PRX.